tech.
You can kind of hear a little bit of feedback, but I'll try and ignore that. Go ahead.
Okay, great. So tell me about being elected as the district attorney in Jefferson County.
Well, I was appointed as a district attorney in Jefferson County in 1977. Thereafter, I ran in 1978 and was an elected official in Jefferson County. I became aware that the Rajneeshis were moving into the area, and most of the ranch was located in Jefferson County, but it also was in Wasco County. And as I indicated to some of the folks that I knew in the Attorney General's office, that I said, this thing is probably going to be a very big matter. And I said, it needs to be kept track of. And as it turned out, I was exactly right. I was in the position of district attorney until February of 1988, well, until after the Rajneesh situation had resolved. I lived in Madras. Although most of the Rajneesh ranch was in Jefferson County, Antelope was in Wasco County, and most of the population of the Big Muddy Ranch, including the Rajneeshis when they moved in, was in Wasco County as well.
So what was the nature of your concern when you talked to the Attorney General's office early on? The thing that the Rajneeshis kind of first came to the governor's office on was the land use issue, but that was mainly with Wasco County. So what did you see?
Well, from my point of view, I was concerned about the land use issues as well.
Mm-hmm.
One of the concerns that we had was using the area out there for festivals. So we ended up in court as well, although as it turned out, we ended up giving them a permit for, and when I say we, the Jefferson County gave them a permit. We challenged it, and well, we were challenged for our first refusal, I believe, and lost. And so we had it began with land use issues. And Jefferson County is a rural community that was trying to preserve farming land. And some people may question whether that was the motive, but I can say without any reservation that Herschel Reed, who was then the county judge, the head commissioner, really was concerned about preserving agricultural land and not having, city-like activities invade areas where there would end up being a dispute. For instance, when you have a development that goes near farmland, a typical dispute is like weed spray and that sort of thing. So we were concerned about development in the wrong areas, and we were trying to comply with the land use laws.
Has 1981 turned into 1982, there were plans for their first festival that would take place in the summer. And those plans, I've seen the state police were involved, the governor's office was watching on the side, they were working with county agencies. Were you involved in any of the discussions about planning for that first festival?
Yes.
And what were the concerns aside from, you know, an estimated, at that point they estimated a few thousand would come, and then the next years it was estimates of like 15,000 would come out. What were the concerns for that first festival?
Well, first I was concerned, just like any large group of people, how would crowd control be handled? How would arrest be handled? When you're in a small county, the budgets are extremely limited. So how would that be funded? what kind of response team would we need, or response time would we need? What about ambulance services? What about fire services in the event that that occurred? Would we be in compliance with land use laws? At the time that this happened, this was a very volatile situation, and we were concerned not only just from the standpoint of a large number of people, but there were also a number of citizens that were very concerned about the Rajneeshis, and some of them had said, in fact, that they might do bad things. So we were concerned about the possibility of violence.
Where did the concern that I've seen was especially citizens in Antelope who were given to taking their guns to public meetings. Did that spread over into Jefferson County, or were you and the Wasco County people working together on a lot of this?
We tried to mediate the disputes. We were concerned that nothing happened. I invited the mediation services of the federal government to come in and see if we could establish a dialogue so that there wouldn't be any violence. I think Bob Lamb was the person who was in charge of that service, and he sent down a fellow, a very competent fellow named John. I forgot what John's last name was. But he came down, and we tried to have dialogue to dissipate some of the really hard feelings that existed between local folks and the Rajneeshis.
And from my reading of things, those tensions were pretty strong in the spring. There's a report from the Federal Mediation Service that puts it at a 4 on a scale of 5, where 5 is an outright riot. But then they calmed down as we got into the summer. Did you have a sense of that as you went on?
Well, I think most people were satisfied that the government, i.e. the state of Oregon and the other jurisdiction, Wasco County and Jefferson County, were trying to deal with the situation in compliance with the law. So many of the people backed off. That doesn't mean that there wasn't really hard feelings. And I'm not suggesting that the folks who lived in Antelope weren't very, very concerned, as they certainly had the right to be. But we were concerned that there not be any unnecessary violence. And we were trying to make sure that that didn't occur.
What did you hear from the governor's office during this? Bob Oliver was out there occasionally, but did you hear directly from him on things, or were you just reporting to them? How did that relationship work?
Well, my recollection is that I actually had a number of conversations with Bob Oliver, and so I never spoke to the governor. Mm-hmm. I always spoke to Bob Oliver, who I believe was one of his key people,
but
that was my interpretation. And so he would ask me many questions, and I would give him my interpretation. I don't believe that Mr. Oliver relied on just my interpretation of facts. I think he asked for others as well, to include the Attorney General's office, the state police. I don't know who he may have spoken to in Wasco County, but I know that when Mr. Oliver called, he was at the top of my list to return the phone call to. And I never expected a call from the governor himself.
Right.
But I knew that my concerns were getting through to him.
There was a sense, in fact, I just spent this morning with Jerry Thompson, who she sends her greetings. She realizes she really hasn't talked to you since she's left, since the governor left office. But she had great faith in you. go ahead.
Well, I appreciate that, and I think there was a real sense, at least by me, that, and I can say a little more about that if you're interested.
Mm-hmm.
I was really, really trying to do the right thing, and I was a district attorney in my early 30s, And Dave Frohnmayer was the attorney general, had been one of my professors at the University of Oregon. And this, I just knew this was going to be a defining moment in the history of the state of Oregon. And I was really trying to do the right thing. And so I really did my best to work with the governor's office, the attorney general's office, and the secretary of state's office on the policy. And of course, you know who the AG was, Dave Frohnmayer, who recently passed.
Yeah. Who else did you coordinate with inside of Jefferson County?
Well, of course, the sheriff's office and the county commissioners and the local state police. And it depended on what issue it was, but I could be speaking with a trooper one day, and I might be speaking to, you know, one of their top people in the state police the next, depending on what the particular issue was. I also coordinated with the local police department as well as the sheriff's office. And I would talk to Bernie Smith as well. I really didn't I don't think I spoke that much to the county commissioners because I felt like if I was going to be in touch with them, I should do it with Bernie Smith, who was the then district attorney. Mm-hmm. Let's see. Other folks that I spoke to would be representatives from the Oregon National Guard.
Uh-huh. Now, with the Oregon National Guard, Bob Oliver talks about telling the guard just to make sure where their people were on weekends in case they had to do a quick call-up or, you know, respond to anything. Was the guard that you were dealing with, was there a Jefferson County group in Madras, or were you coordinating with the state guard as they were kind of looking over things?
Well, as it turned out, years later, I actually became a member of the Oregon National Guard. I was in the reserves at that point. But when the search warrants were being executed, I actually were at meetings with the Oregon National Guard.
Okay. So that's in 1985.
I don't remember the exact year, but when they served the search warrants, there was coordination that was done.
Right.
And it wasn't that it was done in secret.
Mm-hmm.
There, I also spoke, I believe, to Charlie Turner, who was the U.S. attorney. And there were FBI people who were doing their own investigation.
When did you first become aware that at the ranch there may be kind of more going on in terms of what eventually we came to know as criminal conspiracies and things, there was an eavesdropping system, electronic eavesdropping going on. Eventually, we discover that there's the poisonings going on, and of course, you're involved in that directly, and I want to talk to you about that. There's also a sense that they're using criminal activity to fund things sometimes. There were accusations of drug running and all sorts of things like that. When did that first really come to your attention, any parts of that?
I'm not aware of any drug funding allegations, but I think my wife and I were at home, and a representative from the Oregonian called me a couple of years after I had been sick, which I believe was 19... I'm trying to remember, was that 83... said that Bob Juan had announced publicly that I had been poisoned by Sheila.
Mm-hmm.
And then it just seemed to cascade from that point forward in terms of the wiretapping, the salad bar in Wasco County, the situation with Judge Holtz. It just snowballed. And so...
So when you got when you got sick, did that any alarm bells go off, or were you just sick and feeling really bad, and reporting that?
I mean, well, I was Well, I was really sick, and I looked up some of the articles, and I'll be able to quote them to you, but there were a number of doctors that didn't expect me to recover. I mean, I was that sick. And Dr. Bud Beamer came to my house and had me transported. First, I was stabilized to some degree at Madras, and then I went on to St. Charles. And it was interesting when I was reviewing these articles, kind of refreshed my memory to some degree. But there was a Rajneeshi doctor who came in, a very well-educated man, and he thought at that point, he says, could this be poisoning? And everybody kind of like, you got to be kidding me. Nobody poisons an Oregon elected official. But as it turned out, I recovered by the skin of my teeth, and I have to say that the doctors did an excellent job on me. St. Charles did an excellent job. So did, you know, my local doctor, Bud Beamer, at Mount View Hospital up in Madras. But I recovered, and they diagnosed it as pneumococcal pneumonia. Well, I didn't care what they called it. I mean, I was concerned. You know, I was a new dad, had young kids, and it was obvious to me after what I'd gone through, I knew I was almost dead, but they brought me back, and so I survived. So I do want to emphasize it was nip and tuck about whether I was going to survive or not.
Yeah. Do you know that the governor was also poisoned, but they could never pin it on the Rajneeshis?
Never heard that before.
The night before the 1985 legislative session, so it would be his last talk before a joint legislative session before he left office, he was giving a speech, and he got sicker than he'd ever been in his life, and he left the speech in an ambulance. And
I did not know that.
Yeah, it's wild. They take him, they fill him full of fluids. It's not clear what's going on at all. He is able to get up and give the speech the next day. But they
that's what they did. They gave me a lot of fluids, 40 liters, as a matter of fact.
Yeah. Yeah, he wasn't in long enough to get that many fluids, but boy. And it even becomes more interesting. Barbara Roberts has just been elected Secretary of State and taken office. So that night, and she doesn't know the Atiyah side of the story either, that night she got a call from Jerry Thompson saying, we have just taken the governor to the hospital. You need to be informed because you're next in line. And Barbara Roberts says she doesn't even remember what the next sentence was. She was on the floor. But it was very much like the poisonings in the Dalles. There are only about maybe 20% of those poisonings they were actually able to narrow down, saying it was this, you know, strain of bacteria or whatever that did it, and they could never identify the governor.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's the first I had heard about that, and but that doesn't surprise me because. As I indicated on prior occasions, I wasn't in on the governor's inner circle,
right.
But I think by observation and the governor played his cards very close to his chest. He wasn't the kind of guy who was going to say anything publicly unless there was a good reason for it.
Did that stance ever cause you issues out in the field?
No.
When I'm talking to people who remember that time and who were covering it in journalism and things like that, nobody thinks that the governor ever did anything during the Rajneeshi time.
Well, I disagree. I disagree with him, and I think he handled the situation well.
Mm-hmm. So it was the behind-the-scenes thing that was the most important thing that he could have done.
Well, correct. And I think the governor had an obligation, and I think perhaps he understands it from his background better than most, is the state of Oregon couldn't be perceived as engaging in religious prosecution.
Right.
Or persecution. We had to make our decisions based on the evidence. And there will probably be many politicians who would have used this as an excuse to give inflammatory statements to the press, but he never succumbed to that temptation. It was the facts. It was well thought out. It was tempered. I for one, appreciated where he was coming from.
In Jefferson County, did you encounter people who did not appreciate where he was coming from?
You know, I don't have a specific recollection.
Mm-hmm.
But I will tell you that as a new district attorney, what I didn't expect was that when I was district attorney, that I would have a copy of the United States Constitution and the Constitution of the State of Oregon on my desk at all times to explain to people why we did and didn't do things at that point. And I, for one, being a young district attorney and having many things to learn, I appreciated that we had a governor who was thoughtful and didn't overreact to different situations. And I'm sure was getting good advice in the Attorney General's office, because you just can't go in and start investigating people, religious groups, and that sort of thing unless you've got evidence that, some kind of evidence that crime has been committed. And so Bob Hamilton, who was one of the investigators, would say, we would receive these reports, but until we had credible evidence, there was no way that we could, start this investigation. And then when the Blood One announced that I had been poisoned and there was some substantiation, then that was the basis of, I think, the huge investigation that took place. And although no one ever was convicted, I'm satisfied that there was a thorough investigation. Just because something happens doesn't necessarily mean there's going to be enough evidence to prosecute someone successfully.
Right. Yeah, as they did the prosecutions, it seemed they took the low-hanging immigration fruit that the feds had been working on for a long time, most of the time.
Yes.
Used that
and the wiretaps.
Yeah, and the wiretaps, yeah. Yeah. As you were going through this, what did you think that the end of it would be? The reason I ask is the governor was convinced that this was a cult and cults always burn themselves out. His job was just to make sure they didn't burn themselves out in a way that hurt other people. But he didn't know when it would end, but he knew it would come to an end. What was your sense as you were, dealing with this thing right on your front door?
I can't say that I had the experience that the governor did at that time. He was exactly correct in his evaluation, I think, in retrospect. My concern was this, in making sure that the situation didn't get out of hand, that we didn't have a situation where folks were being persecuted, having violence committed on them. It's easy to say that this was tense, but until you were there and dealing with this on a daily basis, tense just doesn't give the environment a good description. So what I was trying to do as district attorney was keep the peace and make sure that no one got hurt. And then that's typically a law enforcement job, but in a small community, a district attorney is right there on the front line, so to speak. Now, don't get me wrong, I wasn't carrying a gun, but I was the person that local law enforcement turned to for advice on these situations would come up. So I wasn't out there stopping cars or anything like that. But let me give you an example of how something would happen. Right outside of Madras, there was a little way station, and that's where the Rajneesh Bhagwan would drive in every day and turn around and drive back to Annabelle in his Rolls Royce, and there'd be a couple cars. And so this got to be kind of a area where lots of people were gawking at the Bhagwan, and there'd be a couple cars, and he'd be in a Rolls Royce. And so they needed a traffic control person. And so John Granby, who is an excellent state policeman in my estimation, he was trying to control the traffic out there. And one of the Rajneeshis made a rush on John. And so John pushed the Rajneeshi off to the side. Didn't draw his gun, didn't do anything except pushed him off to the side. And so the traffic situation resolved itself. John did a good job. He was a senior trooper. And all of a sudden, everybody comes running down to my office. I mean, it was chaos in my office. You know, the Rajneeshis are saying, you know, John pushed the Rajneeshis. They're complaining about it. John said that he was, you know, doing his job. And the corporal is kind of like the person in charge for the local office. He comes running in. So I got state policemen. I got the Rajneeshis all yelling at everybody. And I got this small office. And I thought, oh, my God, what's going on? I can't even figure out what's going on. The noise is so loud. And so I said, okay. Told my staff, let's gather up all the chairs and move them into my office. And I said, what I'm going to do is I'm going to hear what everybody has to say, and nobody speaks unless they raise their hand and I recognize them. And so Sheila was one of these people in my office screaming at the state police. And, of course, you know, Larry Atkins, who's another retired state policeman, he was the corporal. And, you know, he was concerned about what was going on because that is the station. I said, nobody speaks unless I recognize you. And you can well imagine Sheila is not used to that. She's used to thousands of people bowing down to her. And she'd try and interrupt me. I said, now, Sheila, I told you, you don't get to speak until you raise your hand, until I recognize you. We got it all sorted out. But that was the kind of craziness that I was dealing with. And so can you imagine people just come? I mean, it was just like we're all standing there and this huge number of people all come running into my office. So what's that big an office? I had two secretaries out in the front. My deputy was in a different office separated by a few feet from where we were at. And then my office was adjoining the secretaries. That being said, that's the kind of craziness where I'm having to say, everybody sit down. State police, you sit down. Rajneeshis, you sit down. Nobody says anything until I recognize you. Nobody says anything. You know, and it was just nutty. And, of course, I'm getting all kinds of phone calls all the time. And then I prioritize the call. Like, if Bob Oliver called, by God, his phone call was at the top of the list. Dave Frohmeyer's office call, that was at the top of the list. I remember one morning I got out of the shower, and my wife says to me, there's a congressman named Bob Smith who wants to speak to you. I said, I'll take the phone call. So I'm sitting there wrapped in a towel, giving, you know, Representative Bob Smith, who was a good guy, by the way. Uh-huh. I mean, and again, I didn't run in their circles. I wasn't in their circle or their inner circle, but they weren't afraid to ask me questions, and I certainly wouldn't have expected the governor to call me. But I know that when I spoke to Bob Oliver, you know, that information was being passed on to the governor.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, what you're talking about this, it sounds like an adult out on a playground.
Well, it was, you know, I was, again, we're talking about Governor Attia, but I don't want to take away from the other three elected, or the other two elected officials, mm-hmm. Dave Frohmeyer and Norma Paulus, who I also have an enormous amount of respect for. We couldn't have had a better group of elected officials there. For from my point of view, and it just seemed like any kind of political turf wars were absolutely put aside, and everybody was trying to do the right thing for the right reasons. And I was a student of Dave Frommeyer's, and I don't know if you know Dave Frommeyer, but
he was my first girlfriend's babysitter.
Oh.
I grew up in Medford a generation after him, so my parents and his parents were good friends, and we've run into each other, so.
He's just one of the smartest people. I mean, there's lots of people in law school that are very intelligent, but I mean, he was one level above us all. And so, and not just smart-wise, but ethical, and I was just trying to live up to the standard he had set when I was in law school. So I just tell you, so I was trying to do everything right. And the advice I got from a sage old circuit court judge when I became appointed district attorney in Jefferson County, and just days before I went over there, he said, and this was Gordon Cottrell, he was from Lane County, mm-hmm. He said, Mike, don't be sticking your finger up in the air, licking it to see which way the wind is blowing. Do the right thing for the right reasons. And that just stuck with me. And that was back in 1977. And so I said, okay, Judge, you got it. And so I was thinking, I'd think about these conversations I had with different folks. And I said, God, I just got to stand tall. I got to do the right thing. It doesn't matter whether I get reelected or not. This is too serious to be having concerns about whether you're going to be reelected or not. There's people who can get killed over some of the things that are said down here.
Yeah. It's interesting that you say that. The governor had a set of principles that he put together over the years. And in the middle of all this, Jerry Thompson was, I mean, the economy was collapsing. All this was happening. She was having a hard time sleeping and taking care of herself. And she said to the governor, you know, I can't sleep. And he said, oh, I have no problem. I sleep like a baby. And she said, how do you do that? And he said, it's my principles. And she thought to herself, you SOB. but one of his principles was govern as if you're not going to be reelected. You know, just do what you think is the right thing, and the voters will tell you one way or the other.
Well, and again, I think I may have shook Governor Attia's hand a couple times going through receiving lines. But we were not buddy-buddy. He was just someone I had a great deal of admiration for. And I would try to be prepared for this interview, and so I kept some of the articles that, and this one is the Oregonian, and this was October 11th, 85. And if I can take this, said, and I'm reading from the middle of the article. In addition to the federal grand jury to be impaneled next month, a state grand jury is to convene next week, possibly as early as Tuesday in the Dalles, to consider evidence against by the 15-member team of a law enforcement agency investigating the guru's allegation of wrongdoing. The estimate to be presented Friday to the emergency board at its meeting in Salem covers only state costs of the probe. By the way, it's $900,000. Okay. The investigation was launched after the deadline for money requests for the month's emergency board meeting, Ray said. And a formal request for the money will come later, possibly in December. And this is when they say Ray, it's Marlon Ray. Ray said the estimate, including cost to the Attorney General's office, the Oregon State Police, and possibly the court system. Governor Attia last month ordered Frommeyer to investigate the allegations initially to handle a charge that Jefferson County District Attorney Michael C. Sullivan might have been a victim of poisoning when he was gravely ill in February of 83. Attia said Thursday at his weekly news conference that he had expected the state grand jury to issue indictments in the case. The subpoena last Friday for Rajneesh would have required the Indian mystic to appear in the federal grand jury in Portland this week. His attorneys, however, were granted a 30-day delay. So I found that reference to Governor Attia, and then I found another article that, let me, if you'll bear with me for a second.
Yeah, no problem.
And this was an article September 22nd, 1985, and this is in the Register Guard. Some accusations did show, and this is from the middle of the article, some accusations did show promise. There had been an outbreak of what was believed to be salmonella poisoning in the Dalles at or about the time he said the water supply was contaminated by Sheila's forces. And the Jefferson County District Attorney, who the bar once said had been poisoned, actually had grown quite ill, although pneumonia was diagnosed at the time. Certain evidence, and this is in quotes, certain evidence independent of the bare allegations coming from the Raj Neesh tend to confirm that the district attorney was the subject of an assassination attempt. Oregon Governor Vic Attia wrote Attorney General Dave Frommeyer calling for an investigation. So the few non-Raj Neesh residents of town formerly called Antelope adopted a wait-and-see approach to the Bhagwan's offer of truce, which included a call to restore the town's original name. And they've made so many statements, I don't pay any attention anymore, said Phil Hill, a retired county worker. He estimates his family is only one of four left out of the 23 living in Antelope when the Raj Neeshis begin to buy a property as a first step to eventually taking over the town's city council and police force. Let's see if I can see anything else that the governor said. Well, I'm sure you have access to that. But here's what I like about what the governor did. He didn't overstate it. He did it the right way. He asked that the attorney general conduct an investigation. His comments were prudent and well thought out. I believe that he coordinated the efforts to include the state police because ultimately in the executive department, he would tell the superintendent of the state police what to do. He made sure that they were resourced. And work with the Secretary of State, Norma Paulus, when that whole situation about the attempted voter fraud came into play. So I'm one of those people who thinks that we're fortunate to have Governor Attia as the head of our state at the time this occurred. I think, personally, that the reason why so many people have forgotten about this so quickly is that we had a government at that point that worked well together and did the right thing and handled the situation according to law and observed people's rights during the process. And sometimes when you do exactly what you're supposed to do, people tend to forget it, especially given the nature of our gotcha journalism these days and back in those days as well. People doing the right thing for the right reasons and doing it well doesn't always make the news.
Yeah, absolutely. That kind of sums up Vic's entire two terms in office.
Yeah. And so, again, I'm, a young district attorney then saying, thank goodness we had our governor at that time, and I've always thought that when I've spoken publicly, I've said we were fortunate that we had a person who was at the helm who could have made a lot of political mileage by spouting off political nonsense, but never did that. Everything he said was well thought out and for the right reasons. And I was thinking, thank goodness. Thank goodness we have this gentleman there.
Yeah. A little bit more on Frommeyer. In the fall of 1983, September 1983, he comes up with an opinion, an official opinion, that says Rajneeshpuram itself is illegal because it is a religious establishment. And you can't have religious establishments as cities. And so that goes off, and eventually a court upholds that several years later. But one of the immediate effects was that the state denied Rajneeshpuram regular state money to do things like help to fund the 911 system and for law enforcement. Did you see that happening and have a reaction to that as it was going on?
Well, not only that, but I think they were denied access to the
the feds picked up on it and said you can't get into the database too.
Right.
Yeah.
And so I thought Dave Frommeyer was right. Antelope was across the county line in Wasco County. So I thought he was exactly right.
There was a concern that was raised at the time by Krishnadeva KD, who was the mayor of Rajneeshpuram, that the state of Oregon was wrong to deny the money because the statute said, and it actually said it pretty clearly, that it had to be resolved by a court or by something authoritative, not just by an attorney general's opinion. Did that come up as you were looking at that?
Sorry, I don't have a recollection of that.
Okay. Yeah, it's just one of those things. I mean, when talking about Dave Frommeyer, the morning that we learned he had died was the afternoon I was going to call him to set up an interview. So
well,
it's just one of those things.
I'm trying to think of the reporter at the Oregonian.
Les Zeitz?
That's the fella.
Yep.
I've been trying to get him to write a book on the Rajneeshis. You know, every time I talk to him, I say, you need to write this book. I think he would do a good job.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and I'm now getting Jerry Thompson to really seriously begin to give me all the files that she has, which is what Les needs to make a full book out of. For me, it's going to be a chapter. But there's a lot to be said in here. And just one more thing before we end. By the time we get to 1984, 1985, in the governor's office, there is actually an amazing amount of coordination going on with the federal government. They're having daily phone calls. This is separate from the Rajneeshpuram Task Force, which is basically the state police and local government. Did you ever get a sense of the role of the federal government in any of this as it was going along?
Yes, I knew that they were involved significantly. I was on very good terms with the FBI when I was district attorney.
Mm-hmm.
They would intimate what was going on, but they would never give me specific information. But when the search warrants were to be served on the Rajneeshis, I was told that there was a SWAT team there, or a special team that was there from the FBI. And so I was given a lot of information. We set up an area for the state police to be there because that was the staging area of this madras.
Yeah.
But they told me that they had one of their special teams there. And one of the local folks called up and he said, we just saw about 12 guys running by, and they don't look like the kind of people who hang around madras. They've got tiny, tiny little waist, and their shoulders look like they play football, so the NFL. And I said, of course, I knew who they were talking about. And I said, well, I can't tell you what they're doing, but I don't want you to bother them. But let me just assure you, they're here because they need to be here. And that's all you need to know, and I appreciate it if you wouldn't speak to anybody else about your observations.
Yeah. Yep.
And so I knew that of course I was on good terms with Charlie Turner, the guy, and some of the senior folks who had actually been deputy district attorneys around the state. I mean, he had an awesome office, Charlie did.
Yeah.
And they did a good job. So I had a feel for where they were at. It doesn't surprise me that on a daily contact, I knew just through other folks in the Attorney General's office that there were coordination going on, but they were close to keep their cards to the table. And after the allegations came out that I had been poisoned, I specifically talked to the Attorney General's office because I said it would be improper for me to conduct my own an investigation where I'm the victim. I said it just simply would be improper. And I asked for the Attorney General's help, and they were very helpful when they came over. I think if you were to talk to Bob Hamilton or anybody who came over, they said they were impressed by the amount of help that they got from Jefferson County and were very pleased by the reception that they received.
Yeah, one of the things that we do have is we have the letter from the governor to the Attorney General saying, under the power vested in me, you know, go do this investigation. Because it had to be activated a little bit because of, just jurisdictional things like that. But
sure.
Amazing times.
And I have a recollection of that, and the Attorney General's office was welcomed when they got to Jefferson County.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt like I had an excellent relationship with Dave Frommeyer, Marla Ray, all of Dave's, chief deputies and everybody in the criminal section of the Attorney General's office. I had an immense amount of faith. I knew Dave Frommeyer a lot better than I knew Victor Atiyah, but it doesn't take away from the respect that I had for Victor Atiyah because I thought he was doing everything right.
Yeah, wonderful. So any last things about all this?
Let's see. Yeah, I want to just emphasize sometimes it's easy for people to remember when a big mistake was made, or somebody didn't do their job properly. And I think the state of Oregon owes Vic Atiyah a thanks, a belated thanks for the excellent job that he did in handling the Rajneesh situation. That's not to take anything away from Dave Frommeyer or Norma Paulus or any of the other people who worked on this, but he was the head of state at that point, and we were fortunate to have somebody that really was instrumental in making government work the right way at the right time, and we ended up with a situation where it resolved itself peacefully. Now, this is somebody who lived through what I considered a very, very volatile time. And so many people don't even remember it now.
Yeah. Yeah, for people, it's like it with all these things, it hits the local people differently than it does those who just saw it through the media or saw the occasional red shirt go through the Portland airport or something. So,
well, this was a well-known story at the time, but like a lot of things, it was soon forgotten because it was handled well.
Yeah.
But if we had had something terrible shootout like at Waco, it'd be a different scenario here. Nobody's going to forget Waco,
right.
But it's easy to forget when somebody does their job well, and we can say thanks to Governor Atiyah because he did his job well.
One of the interesting things in this is that, because the thing that people have in the back of their minds in 1981 through 85 was Jonestown, where everybody drank
mm-hmm.
the Kool-Aid. And Congressman Ryan, who was killed as he went down to visit the people at Jonestown, his daughter was actually a member of the Rajneeshis.
Mm-hmm.
So it just gets weirder and weirder and weirder the more you look at it.
Yeah. And now let me ask you to, I, or Now, the people you speaking to, do they interpret the situation differently than I, the people on the inside who could tell what was going on?
The people on the inside don't at all. But people who were on the outside, and Les Zeitz does this too, because he doesn't have the documents that Jerry Thompson has. Very little is there a mention of the governor. It's Frohnmayer and Paulus and sometimes Vern Duncan were the people who were the faces that people saw. And then in the governor's office, Jerry Thompson and Bob Oliver were the point people. And the governor made it very clear that he wasn't going to say anything unless, for instance, at a media event, somebody might ask him a question and he had quick answers ready. But he wasn't going to give them any publicity. He wasn't going to give them anything. But they were, you know, until they really broke the law, they had as much right to be here as anybody else. So.
Exactly. And he handled the situation very well. So I'm glad that the people in the know, and Marla Ray was certainly one of those people in the know, and it's sad that you didn't have an opportunity to speak to Dave before it passed on. There's a person who spent a couple years of his life in the Attorney General's office, Bob Hamilton.
Right.
And he was, I don't know if you've heard that name before, but he was one of the assistant AGs. But I remember speaking to him, and I said, because we went to a lot of committee meetings, and I'd say, Bob, this is a really big thing that's happening over here. And he said, most people don't have any idea yet, but it's going to be a big thing. And he said, oh, Mike, you'll handle it just fine. I said, Bob, remember these words.
That's great. Yeah, at various and sundry times, members of Atiyah's own family went over there. His nephew and his wife went and spent the night there once. And because, you know, the Rajneeshis were inviting people to come over and go to the restaurant and see what was going on. And at Thanksgiving in 1983, that happened at Thanksgiving, at Christmas in 1983, the nephew was saying to Uncle Vic, you know, you should really go over there and see. You know, they're doing amazing things. They're making the desert bloom. And Vic, the nephew says that Vic looked at him and his eyes got really cold. And he said, those are bad, bad people over there. Go back.
Well, he was, you know, just one thought. The inner circle on the Rajneeshis were really bad.
Yeah.
But most of the people who were the followers, they were, the rank and file were taken advantage of. And it's pretty sad what happened.
And
a lot of these people were.
Yeah. Vic saw the same thing. He called them the innocents.
Yeah. And, They were sterilized, arranged marriages, severed contacts with their families, gave away family and fortunes, and just they gave it all for a fake.
Yeah.
And it's tragic.
Yeah.
But there were certainly a lot of bad people in the inner circle, no question about it.
Yeah.
But the rank and file, most of them were decent folks that were just kind of on, as far as I'm concerned, on the wrong channel.
Absolutely. Well, thank you very much. This has been very helpful.
Well, I hope so. And like I said, I will look forward to that. And, you know, we spent a lot of time, but, you know, if you think my comments are worthy of putting in the book, fine. If they're not, that's fine, too. But I just really feel like I owed it to the governor. Again, I didn't know him personally. To really show some respect and appreciation for what he did as a governor.
Great. Well,
and
yeah.
A lot of people may not have it.
Yep, absolutely. So, one of the advantages the governor actually had was that he lived so long after he left the governor's office. And so as the farther it went along, people looked back and said, huh, you did some amazing things. So he lived long enough to have actually people begin to say that to him. But the Rajneeshis, once again, that his side of the story has just never, ever been told. And so I hope to be the one who does that.
Great. I'll look forward. When do you think your book might come out?
I hope next year, but I'm a full-time academic. I just finished a sabbatical. And so, you know, balancing classes and writing is just one of those things. So I hope next year, but books are books. So we'll see what happens.
Well, I hope that you'll keep, just a suggestion, you keep a list for everybody you've contacted and send out an email blast, because probably every single person you've contacted will buy that book.
Oh, yeah, so. Absolutely. Yeah, you're actually my 56th interview, so.
Great. Well, I will buy the book, so just put me on the email blast list, okay?
Fantastic. Well, thank you very much.
All right. I look forward to the book, and good luck. I'm sure you'll do justice to the memory of Governor Attia.
Absolutely. I'll give it my best shot. Thanks.
Okay. Sounds good.
Bye.
Bye now.